Hey, it's Andrew, the Director of Literary Arts. Here at Literary Arts, we rely on our community, people like you, for support. To help make this podcast and all our programming possible, give today, literary-arts.org/donate. Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project is provided by Cole Haan. Cole Haan's shoes, bags, and outerwear go with you while you work your way to extraordinary. More at colehaan.com. In this episode, we feature a conversation with Tommy Orange, the 2020 Everybody Reads author. Every year, the Multnomah County Library chooses one book they hope the whole city will read. Between January and April, the library and their partner organizations host events based around the themes of the book, and they distribute thousands of free copies, thanks to the Library Foundation, to readers of all ages from across the county. Here at Literary Arts, our role is to bring the author to town for a talk at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall. This year's pick is the stunning debut novel from Tommy Orange, There, There. The book, which has been described as polyphonic, has 12 narrators of all ages who all speak to their life experience as Native Americans living in and around Oakland, California. It is a story of lives that are both disparate and deeply connected. What is astonishing about There, There is that despite the multitude of voices, it is also a tightly plotted, tense novel that propels you to its shocking ending. Orange has said one of the reasons he felt compelled to write There, There is that he wanted to tell the stories of urban natives. Most of the fiction he found were stories that revolved around reservation life, and while he loved many of these books, they did not always reflect his experience. This is what makes There, There unique and a remarkable and important book, and one that we should all read. I was honored to interview Tommy Orange at the Sun Valley Writers Conference in the summer of 2019, and I want to thank the conference for giving us permission to use the recording of our conversation. It is a pleasure to introduce Tommy Orange to you. He is was born in Oakland and enrolled in the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes of Oklahoma. He has an MFA at the Institute of American Indian Arts. He's a writer and also an interdisciplinary artist. And we're going to talk a little bit about that because I think that's a little less known about him. He's also been a social worker and a bookstore clerk, among many other fine jobs. There, There is his first novel. It debuted in 2018 and was probably one of the most important books published in that year. Went on to be a huge national bestseller. It won the Penn Hemingway Award. It won the National Book Critics Circle Award. It won the Center for Fiction's First Novel Prize. It was a finalist for the Pulitzer and the Carnegie Mellon. It was one of the 10 best books a year for the New York Times, the Washington Post, NPR, Time, Dallas Morning News, GQ, Entertainment Weekly, and the San Francisco Chronicle, and the Boston Globe. So there's that. But what I'm interested in today is sat down and I'm thrilled to be talking to Tommy today. I'm a huge admirer of the novel. It's an incredible book. And I went through and I sat down, my assistant printed out all of the interviews that Tommy has done in the last year, which are significant, and all the reviews, and I read through them all. And I was appalled as a Canadian that there was a massive glaring oversight in all 300 pages of that research. And that oversight was that nobody, not a single person, asked Tommy about his professional hockey career. This is really serious. And as a Canadian, I was disgusted by this. So I'm going to start by correcting a wrong here and talking about, I want to know about your semi-professional or professional hockey career in Oakland. Can you talk a little bit about that and how you got into the hockey in the beginning with?
Hi, everyone. Thank you for coming out. Long before I ever thought of being a writer or even really reading a book seriously, I dreamed of becoming a professional roller hockey player. So there was a professional team in the 90s in Oakland called the Oakland Skates. And we started playing on the streets of Oakland. I don't know how and I don't know why. I played for about 14 or 15 years pretty seriously on a national level. I was sponsored by a company at one point. They gave me equipment. And I never played professionally. I never was paid. But I was playing at the highest level that you could play at. and it was all that I cared about for a long time.
And at the time, didn't have ambition to be a writer, or wasn't thinking about that at all. Is that right?
No, I like I said, I wasn't a reader. I didn't do well in school. I wasn't. Nobody ever told me like that I was particularly smart or should do anything academically or creatively. And I was good at hockey, so that's what I did.
So how do you get from, you know, national level roller hockey? Because roller hockey kind of collapses, right, at some point. And
it actually died on a beach in Southern California.
Could you say more about that?
It died wearing short shorts, all hot colors, pink, orange, yellow. For some reason, they moved. It went from being at the Oakland Coliseum, where the Warriors play, to this much less known Henry J. Kaiser building in near Lake Merritt in Oakland. It's still somewhat big, to a small rink on a beach, and everyone wearing these short shorts with very bright pads. It's because rollerblading as a thing died in the early 2000s. Everyone realized how dorky it looked suddenly, and they were like, what are we doing? And they put them in their storage.
So from hot pants on the beach to being a writer is, you know, it's a gap, right? There's some distance between those two things. What's the journey from there to write? Like, how old were you when you finished playing hockey, and what? How did you become inspired to go on to this next part of your life?
So it's sort of, my life is sort of a story of sinking ships. So roller hockey died, and somewhere in there I was sort of doing a lot of drugs and became a musician. And
it was the sort of rave years, right?
Yes.
Right.
Those were in the 90s. This is a thing that...
Wow. Somebody from the 90s is here.
So I became a musician, and with the same sort of obsessive thing as I applied to hockey, I went at music, and I went to school for sound engineering. And this was 2003 to 2004, or 2002 to 2004. And all of my education was in, most of it was in analog recording. And right as I graduated, the MP3 swept the world over, and all of my education became pretty much useless. So another sinking ship. And so I got a job at a used bookstore. I was sort of like lost and like looking for meaning and reading religious books and philosophy. Yeah. And I stumbled into fiction and I fell in love with it. And, you know, in a similar way, applied the same obsessive diligence to wanting to get better at it. And that's when I was worked at the bookstore. And actually that bookstore, right at the time that Amazon was rising, the books, I'm like putting a curse on everything that I love.
Get out while you can, guys. Because this conference is in big trouble because Tommy Orange is here. I'm kidding. Who are you reading at the time? I mean, aside from maybe some of the religious texts, like who was really getting you excited about fiction at the time?
Kafka and Borges were the first. I think they're a good bridge from philosophy to fiction.
Yeah. So what about those writers really turned you on, though?
I just didn't even know what fiction could do. I didn't read at all. Anything I read in high school, I was just skimming through to pass a test or to, you know, I didn't even care to pass it. I just wanted to not drop out of school or not get kicked out. So I wasn't reading, really. And so when I realized what fiction could do, and they really pushed the limits of what fiction can do in a serious way to me, I knew I wanted to do it. And I read John Kennedy Toole's Confederacy of Dunces right around that time. And the moment that I realized I wanted to someday, you know, try to write a novel, I was actually eating a donut and reading Confederacy of Dunces on a break from the bookstore. And it was, you know... That you can be that funny and sad was just the best thing ever to me.
I love the detail of the donut because it also... And actually, I'm serious because in a way, when you read Tommy's book, the level of specificity and detail in that book is remarkable, and you just saw him do it in speech. That is exactly why that novel functions so beautifully. I want to just pause there about literature to talk about music because aside from from the false start in the audio engineering world, you're also a piano player. And when did you start playing piano?
So I fell in love with playing music with the guitar when I was 18. And then when I was 21, I had a dream where I was lost in a hotel with a bunch of other people. It was completely empty, the hotel, like no furniture or anything. And we were all looking for the same thing, but we couldn't tell each other what it was. And I came out to like the back of the hotel, and I saw a piano, and the white keys were double wide. Black keys were the same. That has no significance, but they were. And I sat down and played a song that I felt came from like wherever the deepest feelings you have come from. And I just knew I wanted to get back to that place.
Yeah.
So I went at it pretty hard after that dream. And right around that time, I discovered Erik Satie, and he is doing something that I wanted to head in that to that territory, whatever he's doing.
Cool. So we actually have a little clip of Tommy playing that I'm going to ask the audio. Do you want to set it up at all?
So I was recently at the McDowell Colony, and this is not really in the family of Erik Satie. This has more of sort of a Russian sound. I was obsessed with Rachmaninoff for a little while, and not that this is Rachmaninoff. Like this is just something I recorded at the McDowell Colony. I was in my room where I was staying. There was a baby grand, and I make a lot of recordings that are sort of like sketches or notes for future piano pieces that I never develop. So this is one of those.
Because if you could just play about 30 seconds of it, that'd be great. Awesome, thank you. That was just recorded on like your phone.
Yes.
Yeah, cool. So let's go back to the novel for a second. And what was the germ? What was this like the tiniest seed for the novel? Was it a voice, a scene, an image? How did that ball get rolling?
So I worked in the at a nonprofit at the Native American Health Center for almost a decade in Oakland. You know, I started off there. It was actually when I was working at the used bookstore. I was part-time there. I was part-time data entry. So at the hockey rink that I grew up playing at was owned by two Indian brothers, but not Native American. These are East Indian from Philly, and they grew up playing ice hockey. And saw they were both businessmen and saw an opportunity for roller hockey when in the 90s, at the height. And so they started this rink. They had a cousin who worked at the Native American Health Center, so an Indian center, yeah. Not an Indian, but. And they said, "There's a thing that where you give preference to. There's a hiring policy or a law where you can give preference, which is not normally the case, but yeah. You can give preference to Native people at Native organizations." So they told me that because they knew I wasn't. Necessarily focused and needed a job. And so I started doing data entry there. And over the years, worked in many different hats at that nonprofit in the behavioral health department at the health center.
Yeah.
I knew I wanted to write a novel, but I didn't necessarily know what. And I didn't have the drive to even start until I found out I was going to be a father. And that really changed something in me to take writing more seriously. I was writing a lot of experimental stuff and it's very unreadable. And something about the seriousness of becoming a father and, you know, the role of teaching another human how to be a human just sort of switched something in me and made me want to take writing more seriously and to start take on like a real project. And so we were driving down, me and my wife were driving down to LA. This is maybe 2 months after finding out she was pregnant. We're going to see Chilly Gonzalez, who's a Canadian pianist. He's very strange. He's also a rapper and a producer. And we were going to see him live, and we were on the I-5. And the idea just popped in my head. And the premise was just that a big cast of characters, all their lives would converge at a powwow at the Oakland Coliseum. That was the seed. I don't know where it came from. It just popped into my head.
Right. So, and when you described a moment when you kind of knew it was going to be a novel, that you were actually going to finish it. I think it had to do with being invited to do a reading for some of the students some of the kids who were involved with the work you were doing at the health center. Is that right?
So it was a year after starting the novel. This is sort of something that inspired me to keep going, I think. My wife was the project director for a youth suicide prevention grant, and we had taken the kids to Alcatraz and had elders talk to them about their time during the occupation. And my wife decided to put together like an author reading series, and she put me into it, even though I had nothing, you know, I was not an author or, you know, barely would be considered a writer, but she was the project director, so. So I read in front of these Native youth something from that first year of writing, and it was, you know, one of the scariest readings I've ever done, and they were really emotionally affected by it, and moved by it, and they, you know, they were not easy to move or to make do anything, so it was a really important moment for the novel for me that I could reach these Native youth. It really, you know, gave me some energy, writing energy to move forward.
Well, it sounds like it's that moment that maybe you had years before in the bookstore about realizing what fiction can do, right? And I kind of wonder, I want to probe that a little bit. Like, what is it that you think, I mean, fiction can do in the distracted world that we live in? What is it that is so powerful?
I think novels, I mean, I think fiction can do anything, and that may sound naive, but I think if you write a sentence well enough and collect those sentences together, I think you can convince people of anything. It sounds like a crazy person, like a Hitler sort of statement. But
and a slightly sinister tone to it, but I'm going to take it on the positive side.
No, I think fiction, you know, I think the possibilities are endless.
So the novel has been called polyphonic by a whole bunch of people, and I think that's true. And the novel has, for those of you who haven't read, has 12 narrators. And can you talk a little bit about why you chose, 12 narrators? And we talked last night. I recognize that not everything is totally conscious in the creation of a novel. Some of it just, I think, came to you. But can you talk about the purpose of having what is essentially a pretty fragmented narrative that does add up, of course, but what's the role of 12 narrators in this book?
Well, I went into writing the novel knowing that I was going to have a lot of different voices, and this is because I like books that do that. One of the influences structurally for the book was Colin McCann's Let the Great World Spin, and I just really like a braided narrative and where you find out somewhere along the way how these disparate voices are connected. I like that experience as a reader, and so I wanted to create that when I set out to write the novel. Later, in retrospect, you know, sometimes I want to sound smart about my book, and I'm like, it's a monolithic community, the way that people think of us, and I wanted to expand the spectrum of what the people think of contemporary Native people. But I wasn't thinking that when I was writing at all. I was just like, I want to try this.
Right. And there's also, aside from the 12 narrators, there is this extremely powerful prologue and an interlude that, it's an omniscient narrator. I don't know if it's Tommy Orange or it's sort of an omniscient narrator speaking to us directly, and it's addressing the reader, essentially. That's how I read it. Talk about the creation of that prologue and then its eventual sort of breakup into the novel.
So again, it was from a craft. It was from a place of loving a certain element of craft and what other books did. So I like prologues, and I like that they can sort of do whatever they want before the story starts. They can break form in a sense. And the prologue was written in the we perspective, even though a lot of people call it an essay now. I didn't write it as an essay. I wrote it as this we voice because I knew how unfamiliar everyone was, including other Native people, with urban Indians. It's just not something that's been depicted in books or in film very much. A little more in Canada, I think. And so when I wanted to define urban Indians and kind of set the context for the characters, I found myself sort of reaching back into history, and this is sort of how the prologue grew into what it is.
I love how it returns in the middle, because I think there was actually one single unit at one point, and then it was broken up. And I think what was your editor just was like, it's too long, the prologue? Is that basically it?
Yeah, she was like, we can't have a prologue this long. And so she didn't give me suggestions of what to do, and I really didn't want to lose it. So I chopped it in half and put it in the middle and called it an interlude. This is how that happened.
And it made it into the book. It's the perfect solution. I think it's that great touch point in the middle of the book to return you to historical context that the characters are operating from, but not consciously necessarily, whether it's we're talking about historic trauma or, you know, their ancestors and what they went through. So I think I think it's a beautiful solution to what is a very complicated problem in the sense of setting context for people who don't have the information they need to understand where these characters are really coming from.
And if it's the kind of craft decision, if you pitched it to your MFA professor, they would tell you to never do that.
I also think there's a way in which, you know, I was talking to a mutual friend of ours, Trevino Brings Plenty, who's a Native writer in Oregon, about the book, and he was pointing out to me too that you can also read it on a couple of different levels. One level that I completely missed, I just confess, until he pointed out to me, and that was there are all kinds of interesting little bits that refer back to the cliches or biases about Native populations. So there is one that, like the two shoes, the bear, sort of talking to I think it's Jackie Redfeather as a child, and you know it's this idea of like, well, the talking animals to the Native American kind of trope. Were those things you were doing consciously in the novel? And there's other examples of it throughout, because you're talking, who was the audience for this book originally? We know who the audience is now. And were there ways in which you were thinking about that book on the multiple levels, or was that more unconscious for you?
I mean, when you write something over a six-year period, there's a lot of thought you put into it that you don't end up remembering. And I don't know that I consciously was like, I'm going to do this thing with talking animals. You know, the teddy bear idea, I don't know where it came from. This kind of goes into our conversation about the unconscious and how much it informs. It starts to get into very woo-woo territory when you, if you dig into it too far around like who's writing the book. But I do believe that, you know, you get involved with something, a six-year art project, and weird things are going to happen that you didn't intend necessarily.
Sure. I mean, certainly from my experience in talking to writers, there's a lot of unconscious, a lot of them have talked about, well, I didn't understand how this happened in the book, but it happened, and it was only when people talked about the book later that I even realized that I'd done that. I mean, I think that's something I've heard. I don't know, probably many of you have too, coming to this conference. Can we go back to the MFA system a little bit? Because you had mentioned earlier in this conversation, like not being encouraged as a youth to, you know, you were sort of pushed into the athletic world, and we're not told to go and pursue or encouraged to go pursue art or intellectual pursuits. And you later did an MFA, but we had a conversation about the MFA program, and IAIA is the Institute of American Indian Arts, and it's in Santa Fe. It's a low-res MFA program. It's, I think, one of a kind, maybe, in the country for Native writers. Can you talk about why that program really worked for you, and the whole notion of like culturally specific kinds of educations can be extremely valuable in certain situations? Can you talk about that program? Because I think that there's a way in which the MFA system is producing a lot of writers who sound a lot alike, and it can be a dangerous place. You made a joke earlier about, you know, if you'd pitch the prologue being split up to your MFA director, they'd be like, that's a ridiculous idea, and it's the best-selling book of 2018. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I was sort of anti-MFA, just based on, you know, having kind of taught myself to write and just doing it completely on my own, and knowing that historically writers became writers by writing and by reading and not by going to MFAs. I tend to read a lot of contemporary fiction to kind of keep my finger on the pulse, or have been doing that since I have been trying to become a writer. And I just noticed the kind of safe voicelessness in contemporary fiction that that I knew was coming out of MFA programs, because you can like read bios on the back or on the you know, back flap. So this particular MFA, I didn't know anything about it. I was in a workshop. I was teaching. I was a digital storytelling facilitator for years at a nonprofit out of Berkeley. And there was a poet who just had graduated from an MFA somewhat recently. And she overheard me telling my colleague that I got into the McDowell Colony, which I didn't know was a big deal. I'd copied it from somebody's CV. I'd seen it, and I was like, oh, I should apply to that, not knowing it at all what it was. And so she heard that, and she was like, oh, you need to be in an MFA. And so she started researching for me on the spot. And she knew I was a father and had a family. And so she looked, researched low residency MFAs, and this just popped up in a Google search, the Institute. And it was affordable, and we didn't have to move. Like, you know, my wife has always been a strong believer in my work, but not enough to move and relocate to an MFA program. So I started. I started this summer after that fall in 2014, and it, you know, it was not like a, I don't have experience with other MFAs, but I've heard enough to know that it's very atypical of an MFA program. Not only because it's low res, but because, you know, you're with other Native writers and teachers, and you don't have to explain yourself. You don't. You're not discouraged from talking about culture, and you're also not asked to over-explain, and these are two things that are really conducive to voice and to exploring fiction, not getting caught up in a lot of the things that you can when it comes to cultural stuff.
Well, and I think we talked about the idea that the feedback that a lot of writers of color, Native writers, get sometimes is like either suppress your own voice or exaggerate it to the point of silliness, right? I mean, can you talk a little bit about what you've seen in that context?
Well, I feel like I've been a little bit sheltered from that because of my experience. I'm just aware of it because I've heard other people talk about it. But I think there's always a danger when it comes to your own culture and the American or white gaze, and performing your culture and performing Indianness is something that I, you know, approach in the book. The Orville's sort of afraid of being a fraud while putting on, like he says in the parking lot, he's watching Indians dress up as Indians. Right. And, you know, this is, you know, the book is sort of me dressing up in a way. But because I talk about it and have that transparent layer, I feel like it's a really tricky thing, because I'm expressing my culture and I come from the experience that I write about, but there's always a risk to performing your own culture in a way that is somehow exploitative.
And the book has, you know, each character has a different sort of proximity to this question of being Native, right? And that identity, and they're all a little bit different, and they're all trying to figure that out. And it is this totally self-conscious kind of. And there's a way in which the book seems to be about storytelling, right? What is it, the story that you're telling about yourself, and what is the story that is being imposed upon you by the dominant culture that surrounds you, right? Like, you need to behave more like or less like a Native. I mean, to what degree was that the central way you were thinking about those characters and their proximity to that identity?
Yeah, I think, you know, the central theme to the book, or one of them, is definitely identity. And it's from working in the community and just knowing a lot of Native people. Like, to be an authentic Native person living today, you have questioned your authenticity more than once. And it may be, you know, at the forefront of your mind. Maybe not someone from an older generation like my dad. He doesn't think of it in the same way. He didn't speak English until he was 5. His first language is Cheyenne. He didn't see a white person until he was 4. He just told me this story. He was sitting on a sack of flour at a grocery store when he saw his first white person. And they actually, this is indicative of the town he grew up in. It was a mixed, it wasn't reservation. It was just a small town in Oklahoma. And there were so many Cheyenne people that the grocery store clerk spoke Cheyenne to his grandparents, who brought him to the grocery store. So I think we have such a messed up context, Native people, just with blood quantum and a history of people wanting to romanticize an image of a Native person as a warrior or as, you know, all these different tropes that people have like sort of clung onto. And we've felt in order to be a real Indian, like I have to have long hair or I should be wearing some kind of jewelry or, you know, there's all these different ways that people do or don't dress up. And it's just very tricky territory and everyone navigates it in a different way. And I thought that was just an interesting thing for fiction and to explore that through these characters.
Right, and it's different when you're in dominant culture. I mean, nobody, I have Scottish heritage, but no one's like, thinks I should play the bagpipes, right? And no one's ever asked me that question, ever, right? So it is, there is a different, you know, as a white person in dominant culture, it's a very different relationship to that narrative, right? And the presumptions and assumptions people make about who I am and what I am. You brought up your dad, and when you were in Portland for our festival last fall, you mentioned in the interview that in many ways this book was for your dad and about your dad. Can you talk about what you mean by that?
Well, and this is another thing that I didn't realize I was doing, but the Opal character is very much shares things with my dad. I mean, a lot of my characters are composite of influence, but in terms of somebody who is very secure in their Indianness and does not necessarily teach it to their children, this was my dad. He was very reticent growing up. He was an engineer at the Lawrence Berkeley Labs. He spoke Cheyenne regularly, like in prayer or just, you know, for everyday things, we would hear it. But he didn't teach us anything particular about, we would hear stories every now and then when they came up organically, but he didn't set about to teach us the language or any of the specifically Cheyenne ways. I later heard from my sister, and this actually appears in the book, the Cheyenne way is to let your children learn for themselves and then you teach them. Mm. And it doesn't make any sense because if they learn for themselves, they don't need to be taught.
Maybe it's the express interest in, right? So the book in a way addresses, is it a way in which of talking to your dad about what it is to be you in Oakland in his next generation? Is that a stretch? Is that too much?
I think it's a stretch to think that my dad read my whole book, which he didn't. He told me, you know, he's like, I skipped to the end. He didn't say how much he read of it when he could have skipped from, you know, word two. I don't know. Well, he skipped.
But he's not a reader. Especially for this book, though. That's like, oh my God.
A lot of people I know haven't read my book. A lot of my friends, right. They're not readers.
Right.
I don't blame them.
I want to ask about, to return to some writers. And there, on section three, you've got some, you know, quotes at the beginning of the sections, and there's a really powerful Baldwin quote, which I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with, which is, people are trapped in history, and history is trapped in them. Can you talk about choosing that quote for that section and how you came, and maybe just talk about Baldwin a little bit and how he's meaningful to you as a writer now?
I'm somewhat late to Baldwin. I just read The Fire Next Time last summer, and it's incredible. I think, you know, as a thinker and as a writer, he was so ahead of his time that everyone's just sort of rehashing him now and rediscovering his brilliance, and the way he thought is so applicable to now. And so this particular quote just held so much resonance for Native communities. And, you know, Black and Native history have a lot in common. So it just fits so perfectly in the context of these characters. And the way history gets trapped and people get trapped in history has to do with not acknowledging actual history. And we're just now sort of reckoning with, or willing to reckon with, what it's been like for the first time. It feels like, you know, the civil rights happened and then everyone became complacent, thinking that we're, you know, we fixed it. And, you know, we realized with Trump that it's very much not fixed. And I think, you know, this time in this administration has really brought up things that we need to be thinking about. And if we would have got a liberal president, I think a lot of things would have stayed under the surface. And I think stuff's come up that needs to come up.
Well, you talked about earlier two people who played a role in the success of this book, and one of them was Donald Trump, and the other is Sarah Jessica Parker. And so these are an unlikely pairing at the best of times, and as related to Tommy Orange, even weirder. So can you just talk about surrogate Jessica Parker and how she's even remotely involved in this process. I mean, I sort of think I understand the Trump thing, but I want you to talk about that a little bit too.
So when everything started to get weird, there was a particular day, just in terms of what my life was before and what it is now. I got a text from my agent saying, this is going to be the weirdest text I've ever sent, but Sarah Jessica Parker wants to talk to you. And I was like, I don't even know what this means. but I found out she wanted to start a literary imprint through Hogarth, and she had read my manuscript because she was in the book club with an editor from Hogarth. And so my book was going to go to auction with a bunch of other publishers, and she tried to preempt it. And it was very tempting. It was a sizable amount of money. But her editor had said something that scared me, which was, Sarah Jessica Parker will be the face of your book. Like it was a good thing.
Nope. So you didn't go down that path, quite obviously. We're coming up on time. We're gonna have some time for questions in just a minute. But I want to just skip to something else. Another aspect of your artistry, which is we've got a 3-minute video that you made, a digital storytelling. Can you talk a little bit about making this video, how it came to be, and then I'll ask our friends at the AV to run it.
Sure. So I worked for 3 years at this nonprofit in Berkeley called Story Center. And we would run 3-day workshops, largely with marginalized groups. We would teach them how to write 300-word compelling personal narratives, normally about transformation. And the nonprofits would use it for, for their website or for just getting messages out about different communities that normally are sort of voiceless. So over the 3 days, we would teach them non-writers how to write 300-word narratives, and we teach them digital video editing, and then they'd have a 3-minute film by the end of it. This, I made, one of the facilitators at Story Center asked me to be a participant, and it was a visual cue. You were supposed to bring something visual and then write a story from it. So I made this in over a 2-day period, and it was right as Standing Rock was happening. And so I very much had that on my mind, and this is sort of where the story came from.
And the music in this is also yours?
Yes.
Right, okay. Tobias, could you go ahead and play that video for us?
These are some of the first films ever recorded. Thomas Edison chose these. These he thought we should see, but should be captured in motion. There's a beautiful kind of noise to them. Something old, something lost. What you're seeing here is the ghost dance. But they're not dancing it. Not really. This was 4 years after the Wounded Knee Massacre, which happened as a result of the ghost dance. The dancers here performing as actors in a practiced ghost dance act, having joined Buffalo Bill's Wild West show. They're performing their Indianness. We keep wanting to see it that way. Indians dressed as Indians, the way we want them to be Indians. Headdressed, historical, long gone. They don't want to see us here. Now. They want to look away. Look forward. But it all just keeps looking like the past again. Backward. I don't know how to be anymore. I know that it matters to look, to see. These coming years might come like a cancer. I wonder what in all that we've captured. I wonder who and what will make it through. What will disappear? And what will we decide to keep?
So before we go to questions, I just want to ask what, for you, happens next? You know, I think for you, the novel success was probably very unexpected. And, you know, I hope you're writing, and I would love to hear about the things that you're working on now, what you're looking forward to in these coming really challenging years.
So I'm really enjoying the short story form, you know, being sort of stuck in the world of a novel. You can't explore certain ideas because you just, you know, you have the context that you're in. And so I have a short story collection I'm working on and another novel that I'm hoping to, my agent will approve in September. So we'll see.
And could you make some suggestions for readers out here who want to explore some of the things that happen in your book of writers? Because I think there's been some talk about a burgeoning group of Native writers who are doing really incredible work. Are there people that you could recommend to us who you think we should be reading right now who are contemporary writers, you know, your peers?
I think David Truer just put out a book called The Beating Heart of Wounded Knee. It's sort of like an expansive, sprawling view of Native life from the beginning to now. Therese Myatt, we both graduated in the same class and sold our books within 2 weeks of each other and both made the New York Times bestseller and sort of have taken this journey together in a pretty incredible way. So
Heartberries is so powerful.
Yeah,
oh
is.
My God. I drove out here from Oregon and I was camping and reading that book like at night until like, you know, there was just no light left and I had to put it down, but it is an incredible work.
And it's only like 110 pages. You can read it really quickly.
Heartberries.
Also, Tommy Pico and Lily Long Soldier are doing really cool things with poetic form and for nonfiction. I think Paul Chott Smith wrote a book called Everything You Know About Indians Is Wrong. It really changed the way I think about things. And I think everyone should read that too.
Let's go to questions. So who has a microphone? There's microphones here and over here. And just go ahead and...
Could you say something about choosing the title and whether the reference to a British rock band has some other meaning?
You're referring to Radiohead.
So I love Radiohead, most people do. When I decided on this Gertrude Stein quote, that it would somehow play a role because I felt it was important. And when I decided on there, I was so convinced about the title that I Googled it to make sure nobody else had written a book called there. And what came up was the Radiohead song. So I played the song and I was like, I know this song, but I knew it as track 09 because I pirated the album. I think it was before he started gave away the next album, and I think he was like taunting people to steal it. So the pirated version I had was track 01, 02, 03. So I knew this is track 09, and then, you know, when I listened to it, I'm like, oh, it's there. And so I knew it, and then when I read the lyrics, it was just because you feel it doesn't mean it's there, and we are accidents waiting to happen. And so I just knew it belonged in the book somewhere, and so that's how that happened.
Other questions? Anyone over here, maybe? Yeah.
I wanted to know if you have had some experience with young Latino Americans reading your book and their reactions to it. I had some experience myself, but I wanted to know about yours.
Yeah, I've had more than a few Latino people come up to me and tell me they appreciate what I've done with some of the thinking around the crossover of Native life, their indigenous history, the shared indigenous history. My best friend is Mexican, and we've had a lot of conversations about how indigenous roots with Latino Americans, how that's something that's there and not really ever talked about, but it's like Mexican people are brown because they're indigenous, and he found out he has half indigenous blood. It's, you know, it's more from Central American territory, but it's really something that it's not talked about enough, the shared history, you know, conquered by different languages, but so much of the same history.
Another question over here, maybe, or?
I was wondering how you balanced, when you were writing, the audiences that you wanted to capture. So for some of us who want to tell histories that are not told, to educate primarily white communities, but at the same time capture the histories from our, like, our ancestors that it's so traumatic that they don't talk about. So, like, how did you, like, did that factor into your writing process, and how did you balance that?
I didn't write with anyone in mind outside of the Native community, mostly because I didn't think anyone else would ever read it if it ever actually became a book. And so with that in mind, I knew Native people were pretty familiar with the territory I was treading, so I took, I sort of, with Native people in mind, specifically like with the prologue, which gets a little more into like history, I wanted to write it in such a powerful and compelling way that even if you knew the history and were familiar with it, you would still be moved by the way you're putting it together. I wrote it even harder than I would have if I was thinking of a wide audience. I was thinking of how a Native person might read this, and how am I going to convince them to stay on the page if it's something they've heard a million times in their life? And you know, sometimes within a community with stuff that you already know, when you start to hear somebody sound preachy about it, you get an eye roll, and an eye roll translates as a closed book on the page.
Over here, the question.
I think one of the real virtues of the book is that the reader becomes so deeply invested in the characters. And I found myself wanting to meet them again. I didn't want to give them up. And I was wondering if you were ever going to revisit any of them.
It sounds like a bad word when I say it, but I am well into a sequel. That's the...
Thank you.
Can you say anything about the sequel? Or are you
I'd rather not.
Rather not, okay. Fair enough. Over here, this question here.
I'm interested about that story you told when your wife inserted you into the program. What passes did you read to those teenagers? And it sounds like that may have been had a bigger impact on you than you talked about so far. So,
yeah, the first year of writing, I was sort of auditioning voices. What I read to them was part of what still exists in the prologue. And it was about connecting to the city and being Indian and how that can work. And this part of the prologue that's called Urbanity, I read that. And I was terrified of those kids. Like I am of kids now, like I'm terrified of high school kids. And these Native youth that we'd worked with, you just really care. And so you want to be able to do something to help. And that makes it scarier and there's more at stake. And so with that, they were moved by something that I'd written, was deeply impactful.
You talked about your father and his reticence on sharing Cheyenne heritage and culture. And now that you are a father and you've written a book that is bringing some voice to this, how are you planning or already sharing culture with your child or children?
It's a trick. It's kind of a messed up thing that Native people are always asked, like how they're going to pass on. It feels like the bagpipe Andrew thing. Like, am I going to teach him how to play flute? It sometimes feels it has that weight to it. Like, how are you going to teach him how to be a real Native American? He's going to grow up with a Native American author as a father. He's going to be messed up. No, I'm kidding. But in terms of, you know, the way he thinks about what being Native means, it's going to be related to having me as a father, and that's going to be a gauntlet he's going to have to sort of handle. But we have discussions with him all the time, me and my wife, and he's very aware of who he is and what he comes from, and that it's complex. My wife is half Chinese and half white, and so he has all these different things he has to consider. And he knows who his grandpa is, and he knows that he's Cheyenne, and you know, you do what you can to make sure that he's aware of as much as you can. And it's conversations you have over time, and it's ongoing. It's an ongoing thing.
Yeah, over here, question here.
Thank you. Like everyone else here, I loved your book. You talk a bit about your father. How about your mother?
So my mom is white, and we sort of identify or her side of the family identifies culturally as sort of French. The last name's Lafile, and but actively teach anything about culturally about the white side. It's just the dominant American default white is what we got. She loves Native culture, so if anything, it was a little bit more. But she raised us evangelical Christian, which was its own crazy thing. She's since now gone back to Native American church ceremony, but I grew up. This is actually a big part of my childhood was thinking the world was going to end, and I didn't think. And this has probably influenced like my thinking about school. I didn't think I would make it to adulthood, so like why would I invest in, you know? I didn't believe in Jesus, but I was afraid of hell. You know, it was that kind of thing.
Yeah. Complicated.
It has been a huge honor to have you here, Tommy. Thank you for giving so much of yourself to the novel. And thank you all for being here.
Thank you. Thank you, Andrew.
That was Tommy Orange at the Sun Valley Writers Conference in the summer of 2019. I want to thank again the conference for allowing us to use this recording and also mention that you can hear more of these great conversations on their podcast, Beyond the Page, or on their website, svwc.com. Also, remember, Tommy Orange is this year's Everybody Reads pick, and there are dozens of events and conversations about the book all over the city. You can pick up a copy of They're There at any branch of the Multnomah County Library. Learn more at opb.org/read. Literary Arts will be hosting the culminating event of Everybody Reads on March 5th, when Tommy Orange will be here to speak at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project is provided by Cole Haan on a mission to fuel your big ideas. More at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.